everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Grad Student Coach Podcast, a podcast dedicated to helping grad students succeed, but that has content that can benefit any collaboration. It is an incredibly beautiful evening when I'm recording this. I'm looking out onto my yard, and the sky is blue, the breeze is blowing, it's not too hot, it's not too cold, there's a hummingbird hovering in front of my window. It is just the ideal day. And not only is the day perfect from a weather standpoint, it's also a perfect day for me to talk to you about incremental dopamine and procrastination. Now, I had originally intended for today's episode to be the direct follow-up to the three-part series on realities that I was doing, but I decided I've been pretty heady and deep and doing a lot of abstract groundwork laying there, and I wanted to just switch gears for one episode and do something just highly practical, a little bit shorter, that can hopefully help a bunch of people. So from the title, you can probably tell that procrastination is the problem we're trying to solve, and so incremental dopamine must be the solution. And so what do I mean by all this? Okay, well, for people that don't know English very well yet, what is procrastination? This is a word to describe a certain behavior that many of us have that involves putting off the hard work we're supposed to be doing, and instead of doing that, doing something that's either easier or more fun, thus setting ourselves up for kind of a nightmarish rush to the finish line as we struggle to make a deadline. Now, procrastination is a very common problem for lots and lots of people, and I've had some grad student clients with this problem, and I've been able to help them pretty well with this technique. So I thought I'd bring this one forward. So why do we procrastinate? Well, one of the statements I will make periodically is that feelings run the world. And what do I mean by this? What I mean is that anything that people do, any actions that people take, generally those are motivated by feelings in some way. People are either trying to achieve a certain feeling or avoid a certain feeling. But generally, the energy we get to get out of bed in the morning and do anything, this comes from feelings of some type. Now, this may not always be obvious to us, because lots of times these feelings are very subtle, sometimes they're not. But in the case of procrastination, what are the feelings we're talking about? Well, let's say I meet with my advisor for our weekly meeting, and together we decide that by the next meeting, I need to achieve some goal. And I know this is going to be a challenging goal because I'm going to be getting into territory that I don't know very well. Maybe I'm going to be looking into questions that are kind of cutting edge research, and we don't even know if what I'm going to be trying to do is even going to work well. But it's going to be challenging. It's not like I'm just following some recipe. There's going to be some hard thinking. And so what are the feelings there? Well, if also this week there might happen to be my favorite movie is going to come out on Netflix and I've been waiting for this, I might be tempted to watch that movie when I should be doing work. And so the feeling there is that there's just something that's just more fun than working through my problem. Another feeling is I'm going to be doing this challenging problem, but I also have another thing on my to-do list that's not as challenging. I already know how to do that. It's not nearly as high a priority problem, but it's easy and I have confidence that I can do it. And so I'll just do this easier problem first, even though it's not as important. I'll get the positive sense that I'm making forward progress, but I'm still digging myself a hole because I'm not getting the work done that I really need to be getting done first. Now, it might also be that the particular problem I'm working on isn't one that is really interesting to me. There are a fair amount of things in a grad student's life that are not so exciting to do. Not everything on your lengthy to-do list over time is going to be your favorite thing to do. For example, if you really don't enjoy writing and you're having to write a research paper and that's going to be taking weeks of your time, that may feel like very much of a chore to you. Maybe it would just be more interesting for you to move on to other experiments to look into new ideas rather than writing the old ones up. Another feeling that's very familiar to me is when a problem just feels too big and it's just an intimidating problem. You don't even really know how to tackle it. It just feels huge. You get some subtle undercurrent of fear that there's no way you're going to be able to do it. It's just kind of overwhelming to you looking at that mountain facing you, and you just don't know how to dive in. Finally, there's one other thing. Being a grad student can often mean that, as I've said before, you don't have lots and lots of face time with your advisor, so you're kind of on your own. This is the time of your life where it might be the first time that you're having to take responsibility for managing all of your time and making sure you get things done, and so you're only accountable to yourself. But if it's yourself that's deciding to watch Netflix, that's not working very well. So there's no like external accountability here, and that's one of the things that can help keep us on track. If we know somebody else is in the game with us, that somebody else cares about what we're doing, then we're more likely to meet that challenge. So how does procrastination typically show up for somebody? Well, if they have been given guidance that by the next meeting with the advisor, they need to have goal X accomplished, the pattern would likely be that for the first 3 or 4 days, they don't do anything about that. And then for the last few days, it's a marathon sprint trying desperately to get it in under the wire. So the cycle of feelings involved in this week would be, the first part of the week would be a mix of anxiety about the fact that you're not doing the work and trying to enjoy the things that you are doing, but still having that ever-present worry. And then the second half is just working as hard as you can, trying to make sure you get it done. Maybe you're not sleeping well, maybe you're not eating well, maybe you're not exercising. Things are just very much out of balance, and you get into this boom and bust relationship with your work. Now, if you do succeed with this sprint at the end, it can be a really great feeling, and this is where the dopamine comes in. So what is dopamine? Dopamine is a brain chemical that's related to pleasure, feeling pleasure about things. And so when something good happens to you, you get a little hit of dopamine, and that's how your brain experiences pleasure. Now, if you were on one of those sprints where you had to do this Herculean amount of work to get things done under the wire, your dopamine hit will probably be huge, like, yes, I did it. I blew 3 days of my week, but I'm so good that I just came back and crushed it for the last 4 days. So that'll be a big dopamine hit. If you didn't get the work done in time and ran into that problem and it was a big problem, there's no dopamine hit. It's a different chemical entirely, and I'm not up enough on brain chemistry to know which one that is, but it's not dopamine. But the important thing to get across is that a procrastinator's lifestyle is kind of like a roller coaster ride. And for some of my clients, this has been an exhausting process, and they just wanted to get off that ride. And so how do we do something different? Well, I have a philosophy about problems, and that is that big problems just are never solved. Nobody has ever solved a big problem. What they've done is they've broken big problems down into smaller problems, and they solve those smaller problems. So many of the problems that grad students face are big problems, like write a research paper. And you can't just write the paper. First, you have to make a whole bunch of decisions and ask yourself a whole bunch of questions. Like, first I have to write the introduction, maybe. How much should I say? What should I say? How many paragraphs do I have to say this in? Can I fit this sentence in? Is this sentence too long? Each one of these questions represents a smaller and smaller problem that needs to be solved as you break down the big problem, the unsolvable one, into tinier pieces that you can actually solve. And what is it about a smaller problem that makes it easier? Well, you know, intuitively, you'd say, well, of course, it's a smaller problem, so it's easier, but, like, think into it a minute. One of the things about a smaller problem is that it covers a much smaller landscape. There are far fewer issues to consider when thinking through this smaller problem, and this is a key that we'll get back to later. But the essence of our approach here is going to take a big problem and divide it up into smaller pieces. Remember those feelings I talked about in the beginning of the episode where, what are the reasons we procrastinate? Well, it's maybe not as fun to do this as something else. It's not as easy as something else. So what dividing a big problem into smaller problems does is it addresses two of those kind of head on. Obviously, it addresses the problem is too big problem, but it also gets to the this is not as easy as other things problem, because by making the problem smaller, it is easier. Now, you might even add a third aspect there about accountability, but we'll tack that on at the end. So the task at hand is to take that one giant dopamine hit and to break it up into smaller ones that you can give yourself on a more regular basis. So rather than being a roller coaster ride, your week is more of a smooth progression through the problem. So ideally, when you're there at your meeting with your advisor and you're deciding on the goal for the coming week, the ideal situation is to reserve 5 minutes at the end of that meeting so that you can break down a plan that is hopefully in increments shorter than a day's worth of work. So you get maybe 5 to 7 steps that you've broken your problem down into. And it's ideal if you can do this either with your advisor or in the presence of your advisor so that you can explain this plan. Now, the beauty of doing this with your advisor is that if you lay out a plan, it offers an opportunity for the advisor to realize if you've misunderstood something. If you misunderstand something and you just go off without telling them what you're planning to do specifically, you might wind up doing the wrong thing and wasting the whole week. So if you can cook up this plan and divide it into a sequence of steps that you can articulate well enough, it will expose those missed, those misunderstandings and maybe unexpressed assumptions about what was supposed to happen. Now, this can be especially important for international students who haven't mastered English very well, assuming that the professor is English-speaking. In my experience, it's very easy for people that don't speak the same language to wind up being off page when neither of them thinks they are off page. A discussion is had about what the plan is, and due to the not quite understanding the language correctly problem, or not quite understanding what the non-English speaking person is saying problem from the advisor's side, our brains can pull a trick on us that goes something like, I'm having a really hard time understanding them. I think I finally do. I think they've got it. I've succeeded in crossing that bridge. It's a job well done. But meanwhile, all the while, that bridge has not been crossed, and the two people have completely different understandings of what has been said. So having this opportunity to lay it all out can be a huge help for international students. Now, if you don't have time during the meeting with your advisor to do this process, The next best thing is to do it immediately afterwards, where you say, okay, I'm going to go off and break this goal down into some steps, and I'm going to either email or Discord or Slack message you what these steps are so that you can verify that you think this is a good approach. But if there's any way you can get them to actually vet your plan, that puts you in the best position to know that you have not miscommunicated with them and you're on a good track. Okay, now we get back to this accountability notion. So one thing I've done with my clients is I recommended that they do the following. So this is a lightweight accountability protocol that I've come up with or reinvented, or maybe everybody does it anyway, but this was novel to the people I was working with. So the process goes like this. Let's say you have divided your goal up into five pieces. You're going to try to do one piece essentially each day of the week. After you finish the first step, you send your advisor an email or a message that just has the message 1/5. That's all it is. It's an expression that you've finished one step of five. It takes almost no time to do. It takes almost no time for them to consume. And so in this way, it's a very lightweight protocol. So what are the benefits of this? Well, the advisor will maintain an ongoing sense of your progress, which is a good thing, so that when you get together the next time, they'll have an expectation of knowing where you are. So let's say you hit a snag, like let's say one of the things you were going to try to do, your step three, was to see if some algorithm would meet some bar, or see if some piece of information could be found, and you can't find it, it just didn't work, then you can add a little note to that as part of this lightweight protocol. So you could say, step three of five, ran into snag, won't work. Then, depending on what your conversation about all this was before, you can either move on to the next piece, assuming it wasn't reliant on the unworkable piece, or they might chime in with a recommendation on something else to do. But so it's just a way of keeping them in the loop and helping to get you unstuck if that's what they've decided they want to do if you hit that snag. Now, another key benefit of doing this is that you actually stay a little bit more connected to your advisor. Now, if you remember, in the last episode, I talked about degraded presence, and I focused on communication channels involving more or less degraded emotive signal. Well, when you are in a limited FaceTime situation with your advisor, that is another flavor of degraded presence, where your state of being is just unknown to them for almost the entire week until you get a chance to see them again. So when they see your 1 of 5, 2 of 5, 3 of 5 emails going by, you are literally just a little bit more in their mind and also a little more in their heart and just a little bit more connected as a human out there working with them. Now, dopamine works for everybody. So if your advisor sees an email from you that says 1 of 5, they're going to get a dopamine hit from that. They're going to be psyched that you're making progress. That's going to elevate their day a little bit. And that is something that is something that you want to do. If you have an opportunity to give them good news on a regular basis without spending a lot of time or taking a lot of their time, that's just pure gold from a relationship building and maintaining standpoint. Another benefit of this accountability protocol is that you feel less alone. It just reminds you that you are in a collaboration with somebody. You're in it together, that there is a notion of us, and that somebody cares what you're doing. And so it can give you, you don't only get the dopamine hit that you got it done, you get the dopamine hit that somebody cares. So if you think of all the emotions that you carry into a weekly meeting when you've been trying to accomplish something, and you're kind of bringing those results back, all those feelings of anticipation and concern about what are they going to think. If you know that they know you've been making progress all week, you're going to be much more confident coming into that meeting, and they're going to have more confidence that what you're going to be sharing with them is good news. And so there's just kind of like a certain amount of energy that you don't have to spend worrying about how the meeting is going to go. And likewise for them, they don't have to spend that energy worrying about how your progress has gone, because both of you know that you've been making that progress and you've stayed on the same page. But what if your advisor is just too overwhelmed with all the stuff they have to do that even getting simple emails like that is too much for them? Well, the fallback position might be just to find a friend. You won't be keeping your advisor in the loop, but you will get that somebody cares enough about what I'm doing to know how it's going for me. And so if you have somebody you trust, like a friend, especially if they don't get that email from you for a long time, they might ping you and say, "Hey, what's going on? I thought you were going to send me an update yesterday." What I did for one client was I offered to be the surrogate advisor because they were very not very confident about imposing this protocol on their advisor. So what we decided to do is that they would just do this to me for a few weeks while they got comfortable with it. And then once they got a better footing with it, then they would bring it to their advisor and they could say, "Oh, I was doing this with Jed and it found out it really helped me stay on track. Would you be willing to do it?" And so it can be kind of a transitional thing in that regard to have somebody else do it. Also, I think I recall that one of my clients did this for a while, just until they could kind of kick their procrastination habit, and then they just got better at doing things more regularly, and the advisor would always know that they were going to be doing things more regularly, and they just got into a better workflow and just didn't need to do that communication. So you may find that this is something that works for you and you want to keep doing it, or you might want to just do it for a little while. But whichever the case, this process has so many upsides because of all those benefits I was talking about. It really is a powerful strategy. So I wanted to circle back to this breaking down problems idea for one more quick pass, just to talk about why it's so powerful to do this. What is so much easier about these smaller problems? Well, I think I mentioned it's a smaller landscape to worry about. There's just fewer factors involved to juggle in your head. The goal is a smaller, tighter goal. It's just easier to conceive of. It's a problem that's easier to climb back into if you are distracted. If you're just lost in this big problem and you don't have a good grounding in exactly the little bit that you're working on, finding your way back in there can take a lot of time. So if you're just working on a tiny piece, it's really easy, a lot easier to climb back into the problem if you get pulled away. Another more subtle thing, but important, is that your mind is more focused in the present. Since all you have to think about now is this one smaller task, you're not thinking about the bigger task, and you're less often pulled into a fear of the future, worrying about, am I going to get this big thing done? There's no way I'm going to get this big thing done. It's just too big. If all you know is that you just need to get this one thing done today, and if you do, you're just totally on track, that's a much better position to be in, where you don't spend so much of your time worrying about not succeeding, and that's time you could have used actually doing the work. And finally, if you can set it up where you have a more consistent day-to-day sense of moving forward, you'll feel less guilty about doing those other things that you really want to do, like spending time with friends or watching that Netflix show you really wanted to watch. It'll be the reward that you deserve because you've finished the steps that you needed to do that day, and you can experience all those things without the distraction of knowing or having that gnawing, the gnawing knowing, I guess, that you should be doing something else. So for some of you, that might be enough to go on. But for other people, I've found that different people have different ways of breaking down problems and thinking about problems. And so this approach of kind of breaking things down into a linear set of steps is not something that everybody does naturally. So I was just going to talk through kind of how I approach breaking down problems. There's a few different approaches that I use. Maybe I'll be able to articulate at least two of them. So how do we break down a problem? So I'll talk about that for a little bit. So first, if the problem is just too big and you're like, I have no idea where to start, good places to start are at the beginning and the end. And so let's talk about starting at the end. Okay, so at the end of this process, you know you're going to be with your advisor at the next meeting. And you know you're going to be presenting some either information or results from some experiment, or you've written something. There's some deliverable that you're going to be presenting. So the first thing you think about is, what is it that I hope to be presenting? Is it a, let's just say, for example, it's a graph of results of some experiments that you needed to do. Okay, so what's the graph going to be? What are the axes of the graph? What are the units? How many graphs is it? Is it need to be a graph of like an average of 1,000 experiments or just the best one? You know, think about exactly what it is that you need to deliver, and you're going to work back from there one step at a time. And so let's say the goal, you know, is to present a graph that is going to be the result of 1,000 runs of a particular computer program, let's say. Well, you now know you need a program that's going to be able to run 1,000 iterations of something. Okay, so you can think about the problem of writing a program that runs 1,000 iterations of something. You can think about that in isolation of everything else. That's a small problem now. Now, what does that need to run? Well, let's see. In order for the for me to generate the chart, I'm going to have numbers that can be chewed on. So I need to generate output that can be consumed by whatever process is going to generate this chart. And so that means part of my program is going to need to output numbers in this way. Okay, now I have another piece that I know I need to do. I have to write a program that's going to generate output of this form. Now I have two pieces that I can think of in isolation, a relative isolation. And so you just kind of keep stepping back until you'll find that you've filled in all the pieces that you need, because you'll get back to where you are. And so as you go through this, if you write these pieces down, you might find that, oh, there's 15 little pieces I've broken this up into. Maybe those are your goals, or maybe some of them can be combined into goals. So that's kind of the stepping backward problem. It's like, okay, I need to get to point X. What is the shape of the world right before there? What do I need to have positioned to let me go that final step? And so, depending on what the problem is, you know, it could be many different things, but that's the idea, to work backwards. Now, I also have a way of working forwards. I use a particular free online tool called Workflowy for this one. Workflowy is an infinitely nestable to-do list that has very few features, but is very flexible because of it. And so I've develop the skill where I can just say, okay, here's what's the problem. make a bullet for the big problem, and then I know I'm going to make some sub-bullets. And so the first sub-bullet is going to be the starting point. Like, what is the first thing I need to do to get to the next step? But this brings up the question of how big is a step? And so what I usually do is I try to think through a problem first at a very high level to come up with the course steps. So let's say I'm trying to think through a shopping errand. So I need to go to the store to get some groceries. And so what are the steps I got to do there? Well, first, at the highest level, I know I have to see what food I need to buy. Then I'll probably decide how much money I have to spend. Then I'll decide which things I want to buy. Then I'll have to go to the store. And then I would buy them and bring them home. So I just laid out six steps. And so each of those steps would have smaller steps in it. So the step of trying to figure out what food I have would be, well, I got to look in the fridge. I got to look in the cupboard. I got to look here. I got to look there and make a list. And so when I'm doing that list making step, I'm not thinking about anything else. I'm just doing that one step. So that's a pretty, you know, basic way to relate this process of you think through at the highest level that makes sense, and then you just pick one of those things and you start drilling down. And eventually, if you keep subdividing things like that, you'll make your way to steps that will take either an hour or 2 hours or a day or something like that. Now, the nice thing about having an infinitely nestable to-do list like Workflowy is that you might come up with ideas that you know you need to do, but maybe it's not clear to you off the bat what order they need to happen in. But there may be an order that is the optimal order in that it would take you the least amount of time. Like, if I do this first, that'll actually make a later thing easier. Or maybe I could reuse this piece as part of that later work. And so laying it all out so I can rearrange it if I need to is very powerful. So summing all this up, incremental dopamine is a strategy for breaking down your work into smaller increments to make your life go more smoothly and with less stress, and to provide a mechanism for you to potentially stay more connected to your advisor as you work through the week. So may your dopamine be plentiful and steady, which means I hope you have a very great week and good luck with your work. And remember, if you haven't checked out my Patreon page yet, please do so. I have a tools tier there with my first tool, which is the expectation dashboard I talked about in episode 4. I think I'm going to be getting a chance to add to that pretty soon. So check it out. And all right, that's all from Amazed That Hummingbirds Can Fly Upside Down and Backwards Studios. We'll see you next week on The Grad Student Coach. To help me keep this podcast going, you can support it at patreon.com/gradstudentcoach. There you can access additional resources and join the community to help guide content of future podcasts. You can also follow me on Twitter @gradstudycoach.